Hey, you know, I love James Wood, you know. My 13-year-old family dog is named James Wood, you know.
Oh, that's funny too. See, this is the good content. We got to just start rolling.
Hello and welcome to the Ad Fontes podcast. I'm your host for the podcast, Rhys Laverty. I'm the senior editor of Ad Fontes. I'm joined as always by my colleague Colin Redimer, the poetry editor of Ad Fontes. And we have a special guest, another colleague of ours, Nathan Johnson, who I believe actually is the man who stole one of Colin's other jobs. Is that correct?
That's right. It was really a hostile takeover. Oh.
All of our best guests have to steal one of my jobs before they come. And Nathan, is that your dog James Wood sitting next to you? You have a dog named James Wood, don't you?
Rhys does.
I'm a huge fan of James Wood. You know, my elderly family dog is called James Wood, so you know. I don't want to be known as the anti-James Wood guy. That's an in-joke within an in-joke, and that may or may not have been in a cold open just before this episode started. James Wood was our last guest, talking about a piece that he wrote for Ad Fontes. And we're joined by Nathan, who is the provost at Davenant Hall, our educational wing of the Davenant Institute, if you didn't know, because of a piece that he's written for Ad Fontes. When rights go wrong, there you go, there's a tongue twister. When rights go wrong, Simone Weil on uprootedness and the way forward. This is on the Ad Fontes website.
And is that WRITES, when rights go wrong?
No, RIGHTS.
Like rights, wrong. Like juice.
So we want to talk about this piece that Nathan's written for us, which was originally delivered at the National Convivium of the Davenant Institute back in June. And we wanted to talk a bit about the piece and then spring off it into some very interesting topics and questions that it raises. So, Nathan, when rights go wrong, Simone Weil on uprootedness and the way forward. Before we get into an elevator pitch for the piece, who is Simone Weil and why was she interesting to you?
Okay. So starting with who Simone Weil was, she in and of herself is just interesting as a person. So she was a French political activist in the first half of the 20th century, grew up an atheist, became a Marxist, then became an anarchist, then encountered mystical Christianity in the 1930s, kind of had a spiritual conversion to Christianity, although she didn't get baptized because she always wanted to kind of associate herself with the outsider. She was very much an outsider for her whole life. I mean, she spent one whole year working in a factory just so she could understand what factory conditions were like. So then when World War II happened and France got invaded, she fled to America and then went over to Britain to work for the French resistance under Charles de Gaulle. And she was asked to write this kind of political treatise manifesto that eventually became The Need for Roots. And basically the idea was, hey, if we are able to somehow win the war, get France back, how do we rebuild France? And she said, oh, well, I've got some ideas. So she wrote this massive manifesto and then promptly died of tuberculosis. And Charles de Gaulle didn't really read it and ignored pretty much all of her advice. Actually, it's kind of sad. She died not...
And here,
and
we,
here
are.
We are. Almost all of her writings were published posthumously. But then in the 50s and 60s, there became this big resurgence of Simone Weil interest, and it's kind of continued today. Scholars write stuff on her all the time. She's very fascinating.
T.S. Eliot, though, was a big fan, right? It was so it's sort of, she gets remembered not in the French tradition, but more in the American and Anglo-American tradition.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, he wrote the preface to the published version, and you can actually see some overlap between some of what she says and some of what he says in The Idea of a Christian Society. And the way that he describes her is as a prophet, and I think that's exactly right. She's not an insider. She's not somebody who really finds no one would find her particularly comfortable as a political philosopher. She's really just hurling things at everybody, making everybody uncomfortable. Capitalists, Marxists, you know, the whole lot. She's got stuff to say about all of them.
Kind of crazy, right? I mean, I don't want to, yeah. You know,
I mean,
put words
in a very
in your mouth.
French way.
So says the Brit. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, to illustrate kind of her instability, we'll call it, when she got tuberculosis, they said, well, in order to heal, you're going to need to rest. You're going to need to eat a lot. You know, nutrients are kind of important. And you did write this treatise on needs for the soul, which is about nutrients for the soul. So, hey, nutrients for the body are good, too. And she said, well, I don't want to eat more than the people in France are eating right now. And this is in the middle of World War II, 1943. And so she basically starved herself to death. Yeah. So that kind of tells you a little bit about her way of life. But one thing that you can just tip of the hat to her is that all of her ideas are things that she tried to live out. She was not an armchair philosopher or living in an ivory tower. She was very much trying to live out everything that she believed.
Sounds like she needed some roots. You know, like some fries or something.
Root vegetables.
You mean like, yeah, root vegetables, yeah. Carrots. Yeah.
Rutabaga.
That segues us nicely. So, nothing about root vegetables segues us nicely to anywhere. To get to the piece then, so this is Simone Weil, bit of a potted summary. I'm glad to have had a chance to find out a bit more about Weil, because she's one of those names who often kind of pops up in stuff I read, but I've never delved into her work that much myself. So that's Weil's life. So this piece, When Rights Go Wrong, give us the elevator pitch for this. And I asked this question to James Wood when he was on and we were talking about this. And, I said the elevator pitch, and then it must have been the elevator in the Burj Khalifa, because it went on for... went on for a while. Very glad to have James. But so a true elevator pitch for this short piece.
Here we go.
1 minute or less.
1 minute or less. Let's do this. Okay, so the need for roots. Her main argument is that Europe as a whole is rootless, and that in order to get back to its spiritual roots, it needs to follow kind of her program. And so first she starts by differentiating obligations and rights. And she says that obligations have to be the form of the foundation of society. It can't be protecting rights. It has to be carrying out personal obligations. Obligations, you can kind of figure out what your obligations are by understanding the needs of the soul. So just as somebody who's sick and dying on the side of the road, they have needs of the body, and it's your obligation to help meet those. So everyone has needs of the soul, and collectives are formed specifically so that people can carry out their obligations of meeting the needs of the soul of their neighbor. And then from there, she talks about various forms of rootlessness in cities and in towns and across Europe, before finally getting into her kind of positive project of how do you regrow roots. And she says there are five main causes of uprootedness: war, money power, basically economic, the center of society being economics, economic domination, bad education, and the destruction of the past, which she says is the greatest of all crimes. So in order to reroot a society, you have to deal with those five causes of uprootedness. And then she kind of ends with this delightful reflection on patriotism and what it means to have compassion for your country in a way that helps rebuild and reroot your country, but not actually perpetuate rootlessness.
So when you say rootlessness, like, in my mind, the first sort of image that comes to mind is like a hobo, like a homeless person who's not just like homeless and they're trying to like build a little home in like the corner of a park, but like, you know, 'cause there's like one version of homelessness where you're like, I might not have a home that I own, but I have like a tent in a corner, you know, under some cardboard or something. But then there's another kind where it's you know, and I've actually met a few of these people that just like jump on trains and like wander from city to city. And
yeah, I thought hobos were specifically on trains.
Yeah, yeah, that's why I said hobo. But in case our listeners don't know.
But rather than in parks. You, like, you guys have a bigger taxonomy of homeless people in the States than we do.
Right, yeah, that's true. And our listeners might not be as well educated on homelessness as you are, Reese. And so I had to explain the taxonomy.
I'm learning from the best.
So what is this sort of rootlessness, or is she making a broader claim? I know Ve relatively well from the Iliad Poem of Force. I've read the rootlessness stuff, but I'm not a scholar of it such as yourself.
Yeah, so you know that famous line that somebody said, we're all Keynesians now? I think Ve would say we're all hobos now. I think that's basically what she would say. So what basically the cause of personal rootlessness is the fact that all collectives themselves are basically rootless at this point. At least that's her kind of assessment of Western collectives. And one of the reasons for that is that there are no more local collectives. Everything's this basically been reduced to the state is what she calls it, the state. And so when you have that, you have basically a disconnect from the past, ultimately, traditions, ways of life, values, stories. She makes a lot of emphasis on stories, history of the past. And once you become disconnected from that, then you just become this hodgepodge conglomeration of people. And the only thing that connects you together really is a shared border. It's like we're all in this one place that has these defined boundaries, and that makes us who we are.
And maybe the boundaries aren't even
and,
real.
Right, yeah. I mean, I think she might be appalled by the European Union, honestly. because her whole thing was France needs to become France again. Make France again would probably have been her motto if she had been running for.
It doesn't even have to be great.
No, it just has to be France.
Just be France.
That would be too much to ask of the French.
Right.
Is she a monarchist? I know you quote a couple of things where she clearly takes a relatively dim view of the French Revolution. Is she a monarchist? Do you know?
I don't think that she was a monarchist, but I think that she views the French Revolution as a terrible way to go about fixing the social problems of the day. And so you replace monarchy, which at least has some sort of continuity and some sort of binding influence, which she does say that at least is good about monarchy. You replace that with basically nothing but protecting a few spare rights of individuals. She goes through and she bashes the Rights of Man document, you know, the 1789 Rights of Man. And she says that's really where France's modern problems started there. So in that sense, if she had to pick between continuing the monarchy or the French Revolution, I think she would have picked continuing the monarchy. But she also shares a lot of affinity with Marxist thought. So I don't think she would have been a monarchist.
And so on the obligations rights distinction, as I read that through, my immediate thought is that, well, are those not just the same thing, but viewed from different sides? So, you know, someone has rights, and they can claim those rights, and then someone else has an obligation to fulfill those rights. So for her to kind of posit, and she says that rights are subordinate and relative to obligations, but certainly to our way of thinking about rights, you know, several decades later and in the era of, you know, the Geneva Convention on Human Rights and European Court of Human Rights here in the UK and the EU, it seems odd to oppose the two. They just seem like opposite sides of the same coin.
She would sort of agree with you. What she would say is that what we in kind of this this modern liberal world would consider rights is really just a vague and mangled form of what we all know to be obligations. So they're inextricably related. It's just that you're getting it backwards, and because you're getting it backwards, you're actually mangling the whole thing. So a couple things that she would say is obligations find their source from God, but rights are relative. So, and even like Edmund Burke makes this point, that really rights kind of come into focus and come into force once you have a collective that kind of defines and determines what those rights might look like. But obligations are kind of transtemporal.
But classically, wouldn't we say that rights always produce obligations, or obligations are always rooted in rights? And this is sort of the concept of natural right.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would argue that it's actually flipped, that ultimately rights are just the expression of an obligation that's prior, at least prior, prior in the sense.
But I think I'm in agreement. They're the same basic thing, just looked at from different ways. So if you wanted to make the argument for it, just to give a practical example, you got people who claim housing is a human right, you know, and I would respond and say, well, if it really is a right, what do you mean by that? And if what they mean is I just want housing, well, then they're using right in a completely different way. Mm-hmm. If you're using it in the classical sense, what it would mean is there's an obligation that someone house me. And it means if we're sort of alone in the woods and there's a bunch of tools sitting there and you don't know how to use the tools to turn the trees into housing, and I do, you basically have a right to my labor, which is, you know, slavery. If I don't want to build the house, but you have a right to it, I have to do it. I have an obligation. So the right and the obligation can be seen in that sense, right?
Yes.
Because your right to housing is an obligation on the rest of us to get the house in place.
Yes. Although I think what she would say is the force of that obligation doesn't come from the right. It comes from God. The force of the right comes from the obligation. So she's really focusing on where does the force come from. So if you are alone by yourself on a deserted island, you have no rights, but you still have an obligation. You have an obligation to yourself, ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Try to live.
Right. And so if you're taking that scenario of two people in the woods, the force comes from not, hey, I have a right to you, your labor to serve me and help me. Mm-hmm. But that's not where the force comes from. The force comes from God saying, hey, you have an obligation to help that person. And then that person has a right only because you have an obligation to them. So this is where she really, I think, zeroes in on the problem with centering society on human rights, is this assumption that rights in and of themselves have force. They don't actually have force. So you can't, one of the things she says is, when you're thinking about yourself, you can only think about your obligations to your neighbor. You can't actually demand based on some sort of right that I own. I own a right that forces you to do X for me. She would say, no, it's I have an obligation that forces me to do X for you. But when I'm looking at you, I can say you have a right that I need to meet because of my obligations that come ultimately from God.
But you can't look at yourself and say that I have a right that other people need to meet. I mean, you can see why this person worked herself to death.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, I mean, I think we could say, just last thought here, I think we could say it's two sides of the same coin, but I think we do need to at least see that her emphasis, I think, it is persuasive, that ultimately the force comes from the divine realm, not from, I'm walking around possessing certain rights that have almost like magnetic power that force you to do X, Y, and Z. Because if a right is not acknowledged by a collective, it has no power. So I can go all day in Soviet Russia and say I have a right to private property. And people go, who cares? But obligations remain whether or not they're acknowledged by human beings.
Well, No, because you could go around saying you're obligated not to take me to the gulag and kill me, and the Soviet Union is going to be like, yeah, whatever. I mean, it's the same. Don't you have the same dynamic?
Well,
I don't want to, again, I know that you said, actually, when we rolled the tape, you're like, anytime I talk about this, everybody wants to argue with me about the rights and obligations thing.
That's a good point.
And we promised not to, but I can't help myself.
You would actually be walking around saying, I've still got an obligation to my neighbor in Soviet Russia.
Yeah, but that's only because her taxonomy is forcing me to say that. In other words, if I'm just sort of thinking about the language as it functions all the time, you know, you... Like, the counterposition, I think, to what Vey's saying, that as a, you know, that I would be much closer to subscribing to, is to say that you can still talk about having a right to private property, or that I have an obligation to care for my neighbors have an obligation to care for me, or whatever. And it might not have force, but that's the concept, is it's, therefore, it's just not right what the Soviet Union is doing, or what it is as a political organization. It lacks legal force. It's not lawful. I mean, that's the position that you'd end up being in. Is this just like, oh yeah, this is just an illegal institution. This is a lawless place. No one here has rights because they're not in the right. Is that, I mean, I don't know how they would.
I think she would. She
sounds like she wants to force us to talk in a very particular way because she's trying to get us to not focus on ourselves.
Sure.
Is that
fair? You know, it
which is probably a good idea.
But she should probably have focused on herself a little more. So again,
is a healthy way of passing this out? You touched on this, Nathan, in the piece that. This is a different way of understanding how society works to what we now call the social contract, which is from Rousseau. Colin will have taught Rousseau, and I'm sure Hobbes and Locke, who are behind this, many times. So Colin, could you give us a little summary of what the social contract is? And then Nathan, maybe why Vey's articulation of things is different to that.
You know, it depends on which social contract theorist you talk to.
And you, Colin. I want you.
You want me?
Yeah, you, the social contract theorist.
In the
theorist.
Beginning was the Word.
Colin.
And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. It depends on how you conceive of the state of nature and the origin of the political community. And those two things are related to one another. And in modernity, part of what modernity is a re-narration of the origins of humankind and the natural and political human situation. And you can see that re-narration happening again and again. You see it with Rousseau, you see it with Locke, you see it with Hobbes, you see it with Darwin, and you know, you see it with Hegel. This is the feature of modernity. And I think as a Christian, you have to say, that's not really up to us in some level. We can sort of go back and think about what it must have been like, but we have to ultimately say, one, history cannot speak to this, because you're dealing necessarily with something before history. And therefore, is there anyone there who can speak to it? And the closest we have are sort of human myths. In various cultures where these people have sort of preserved traditional stories from long, long ago. And ultimately there's one myth, which is true about the origins of the human species and the nature of humankind. And that's scripture. So that's not the answer you wanted, but that's the answer I'm going to give. And so, you know, I take Simon Weil here to be in that tradition, but trying to find a way to critique it with an eye towards at least the Christian ethic, if not the entire Christian theological project behind it. And so, you know, the text that I've taught the most, which is the Iliad, Poem of Force, you can see her going back to some of the oldest sort of foundational texts, which is Homer for the Western tradition, and then critiquing the impact that that account of what it is to be human and the impact that has had up to today. And so, you know, in her mind, you know, if you ask her where does modernity begin, I think she might say it begins with Homer. That's at least sort of one controversial reading of Vey. And she would say it's because In Homer, what makes you a man is your ability to make other men things. And, you know, if I can kill you, my ability to kill you is my ability to turn you into some inert piece of matter that is beneath me. And therefore, what makes you a human is force. It's just power. And I think I would just, I teach this when I can, because it's a really powerful image of, I think she's correct about modernity. That is our situation. We just love power. We love force. You read all these modern thinkers that are secular, and ultimately they don't care about truth. They don't care about good. They don't care about beauty. They care about power. And I think she's wrong in that. I'm not sure that's the only way to read Homer, right? So she might be sort of over-reading antiquity. I don't know. Is that, this is a lot. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, well, two things. One, that's a great essay. Y'all should do a podcast on that essay sometime.
Well, we should bring you back.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. But yeah, just to kind of respond to that, I think what she would say is, one, she's not rejecting rights. She's just saying that what ultimately holds priority are obligations. So when you form a collective, this is what's so radical about what she's saying. You don't form a collective to protect your rights. You actually form a collective because a collective is the most effective way to carry out your obligations toward your neighbor. So it's like, I'm standing here, I've got obligations to my neighbor because my neighbor has needs. He's got needs of the soul. And God has given me a duty toward my neighbor. The best way for me to fulfill my obligations is for us to get together into a collective where, as a whole, we can fulfill our duties to one another. Now, because we have needs and because there are obligations to meet those needs, what emerges from that are rights. But then rights are sourced in something prior, needs and obligations. And because of that, when she says when rights become contradictory to obligations, or when rights start to overpower our duties to one another, immediately our rights become illegitimate. So this is why, you know, we all have ideas that rights, you can give up a right for the sake of something higher, or a right could be taken away for the sake of something higher. You know, so, okay, I've got a right to vote. Well, if I become a felon, I don't have a right to vote anymore. I have a right to private property. If I abuse that, that property can be taken away. We take away rights all the time for the sake of something higher. Or I have private property, but I can give that away to fulfill a duty. So in that sense, obligations, like, I think we can get this, we can see why obligations in some sense are prior and also kind of more powerful, more inherent.
Mm. And then there's a sense in which obligations and the kind of the communities that mean they exist, that they precede all of us, and we're born into that, and that's just here. And this is maybe the difference between what Vey is thinking about, I think, and the social contract, which by its nature is something that we kind of all individually, rationally assent to, or consent to, probably a better way of putting it, and opt into, whereas obligations precede us, exist, and you assent to their existence and the fact that they're there.
Here's what I'll say, because I'm not sure I agree with Vey, but I think that what she's doing can be an effective rhetorical move, because rights, as conceived in the wake of all these different social contractual theories that you listed, right? Because right looks different if you follow Rousseau versus Hobbes or whatever. In the wake of the confusion around the term, if you talk about it in terms of obligations, you end up cutting off some of the worst options of what we mean by right. Like, a right is just something we all agree on, sort of like a pure social contractualism or something along those lines.
I do agree with that, yes. And it could, part of it is a rhetorical move, and part of it is an internal orientation. It's just like, what's your orientation? Is it toward protecting your rights, or is it toward fulfilling your obligations to your neighbor? And when we have a society that respects human dignity, which she does talk a lot about the importance of respect as one of the needs of the soul. When you respect human dignity, you will protect people's, what we define as people's fundamental rights, because one, they're human, but two, when those rights are protected, they are much more able to fulfill their obligations. So if my private property is always being threatened, then I will have much less freedom to fulfill my obligations of generosity to my neighbor. But if I'm in a collective that respects my private property and it is my own, then I don't have to focus on that anymore, and I can just focus on my duties toward my neighbor. So you can see how actually duties, or how actually rights, can serve obligations if you have it in kind of their proper balance. But what she has seen is the slide in kind of liberal Europe was toward rights and rights alone, and then those kind of get diminished to these few spare rights that are then protected at all costs, and then everybody else just kind of does whatever they want, and we kind of lost our obligations entirely.
Yeah, so to move then from talking about obligations and rights into the talk of roots, because the piece is ostensibly about Vey's book, The Need for Roots, but then a lot of it, as our conversation has been, is taken up with this obligations-rights distinction, but that is tied to the question of roots, and so as I take it, when we live in a rootless society, that is when you cannot avoid an orientation towards rights overtaking an orientation towards obligations. Is that the broad picture, Nathan?
Yes, right. That's what you end up with is a very truncated form of life. So she lists, I'll go through this real quick. She lists what she considers the needs of the soul that a collective is uniquely designed to meet. And this basically informs what our duties are to one another. So liberty, we all have the need for liberty. We also have the need for order. We have the need for personal responsibility. We have the need for obedience. We have the need for equality and also hierarchy. We have the need for honor and the need for punishment. We have the need for freedom of opinion, but we also have the need for truth. We have the need for security. We also have the need for risk. We have the need for private property. We also have the need for collective property. All of these are the soul's needs that a collective designed to meet those needs through fulfilling our obligations. The collective, when it does this, it's a rooted collective. And it's beautiful. But once you become uprooted, you start to actually lose the ability of the collective to meet these needs. And you find that everyone then is in this state of, if you go back to the hobo analogy, well, the hobo is going from place to place. Nobody knows him. So it's really, he's on his own to try to get what he can, survive, and fight off anybody who's going to infringe upon his life or liberty. Not much of a life, right? Mm-hmm. Now, basically, that's...
So is she saying that I'm a hobo?
She might be, Colin.
Are you a hobo? I want to defend myself here, because we began, you know, you said you're a Tennessee man.
That's right.
And I'm a Californian. And Reese over there, he's
I'm a Chesingtonian. That's what I am.
He's a Chesingtonian. Is that a town or like a state or?
This is my town. Yeah. I discovered on my mother's side, her dad's family have been in this area for centuries. So I feel vindicated in that. Yeah.
Centuries. No one's even been. I mean, America. You know, it's like. he's been in Chesington for longer than our country has existed.
You guys can only just about use the word centuries, plural, to describe anything, do you?
So how can we be... This seems like a very rootful podcast, you know. I wouldn't even travel to Tennessee to see you. You know, we would Zoom, because that's how much I love my state, you know, and I'm not interested in your state.
I think she would be pleased with that, Colin. I think she would be pleased with that. Let me read you her definition of rootedness, and that can kind of help us unpack a little bit more what she means.
So you decide if you're rooted.
So we can really, the whole podcast is about deciding whether or not Colin is rooted, or whether or not he's a hobo.
Done.
That should be the title. Is Colin a hobo? So she says a human being has roots by virtue of his real, active, and natural participation in the life of a community, which preserves its living shape, preserves in living shape certain particular treasures of the past and certain particular expectations for the future. I'm going to put that in the chat so you can read that.
Now, could that be a family? Because it sounds like it could be a family.
It could be a family.
You know?
It absolutely could be a
family. There's this, it's not even a nice looking thing. It's just this old, we use it as a coffee table, but it's like a hope chest. And it was like built by some Norwegian at some point in the Olsen branch of the fan. I have no idea, but it just sits there. And I remember being a kid and being yelled at if I put my feet on it. And now I yell at my kids if they put their feet on it. There's an obligation not to put your feet on it. You know, sounds like we have an obligation to just keep this piece of wood.
Well, in one sense, yes. What you're describing is a little bit of a taste of what it would look like if you lived in kind of a pre-modern context. And it's not that she like totally, she doesn't have a rosy-eyed view of everything pre-modern, but the idea that land, first and foremost, something that a family would be on for generations, buried on, worked that same land. And then the community itself has been there for generations and generations. It has particular treasures of the past that are unique to it. One of the things she says is that each collective is unique and cannot be replaced. So once it dies forever. And because of that, she says the destruction of the past is the greatest of all evils. You're actually killing the soil, the nutrients from which anything grows. Any expectation for the future, any progress, any desire for the future comes out of the roots of the past. If you cut those off, then you're a hobo. You don't actually have much of a future because you don't have a past anymore. So all of us have tastes of what those treasures of the past would look like, maybe in our family, maybe with some heirlooms, maybe if we've grown up in the same state for a long time. But even states themselves are losing their own unique identity the more you get transients. Towns are losing their own unique identity.
Yeah, no, and that is definitely the case. So, that, you know, like the little farming villages that my family was in for many generations are now like, it was like, you know, there's one of these is literally called the Swedish village of California. And it is not a Swedish. It's just like any other farming community in the, you know, greater California area. It's mostly Latinos. that's just, you know, those are the agricultural workers that have been moving here for over 100 years. And eventually that's just kind of what the communities start to look like. Not exclusively, but I would say majority. Whereas, you know, certainly I think when my grandfather was living there, it was mostly Swedish people. And there would still, I remember as a kid, you know, you'd go to like the local Swedish Methodist church for Christmas Eve and there would be some hymns in, you know, I assume Swedish, I don't really know. Like one of the hymns, you know, for the Christmas Eve service. So these sorts of things, I guess part of my question is, isn't this change always been going on? So I get a little, again, I can get really on board with the rootlessness thing. You think about the Silicon Valley office worker, and there was a period where, I mean, and these people are just, and I have a whole essay where I talk about how they're just as homeless in a certain sense, because they're not, they're just housed like a warehouse would house a product, like an Amazon crate, like a yellow crate in an Amazon warehouse houses things. And you have these, you know, companies that have actual company housing, sleeping pods, you know, these kinds of things. Or you have workers who know that they could make a lot of money in the Bay Area as long as they're not spending it on housing. So they like live in a van for 5 years working at Google, and then they go retire in Cleveland or something. So, yeah, I mean, I understand that there's something sort of weird and wrong going on that seems new. But at the same time, I'm resistant to the idea that, like, there's this halcyon past which is so rootful. Because, you know, six generations ago, somebody in Sweden and Norway and, you know, Germany and England and the East Coast of America, like, those are my ancestors. And they were like, yeah, let's not be here. Mm-hmm. Let's go there. And they, like, moved to California. So, and that process has also been going on as long as humans have been around, right? You've got, you know, populations moving from the Asian steppe out into Greece. You got the Greeks who are like, let's go take over, you know, Macedonia and vice versa. I mean, you know, this has been going on. So how is our situation different?
Yeah. So that's absolutely right. And one of the things that she acknowledges is, that one of the chief causes of uprootedness that has been around forever is war. So, and war's always been around, and that's always been.
Do I have an obligation? Do I have an obligation to go to war with anyone?
No, but what she would say is that you have an obligation to preserve your collective, whatever that is, which might include war. She talks about that some with patriotism. But she says one of the evils of war is that you uproot the victims of war. You kill them or move them out, or you bring in all of your people. Once you have dominated this people group, you bring in all of your people, and that upsets the entire life of the community, and it becomes something different. So she says mass migration has always been a cause of uprootedness. But what makes our situation unique is how many different causes of uprootedness are all working at the same time. So this is when she gets into...
It's sort of speeding up. It's like an accelerationist.
It is.
Before accelerationism.
And in those... Sorry, Nathan. And in those moments in history where significant uprooting has taken place before, one imagines that that's kind of more clearly perceived as a sort of uprooting but replanting, in effect, of the same thing somewhere else. And so with, you know, America is the ultimate example of this. You know, everyone will still be talking about the old country, and you have Swedish Americans and Italian Americans and, you know, the kind of unique relationship that develops there. Whereas I would think that is far less the case, and it reduces more now to the individual and their self-realization wherever they've chosen to put themselves, rather than them seeing themselves as a part of collective X, which is now in place Y or whatever.
Right, right. I think she would say that the melting pot idea is a really bad idea. And that if you are going to have kind of uprooting, you need to, like you're saying, Reese, replant into these smaller communities of like-minded people with a shared past. You think about like old New York, where... Yeah, you've got people groups that are coming in from different places, but when they get into New York, they form little boroughs that are of their own unique group. And she would say that's better because you still have some soil there from which to grow, as opposed to the melting pot where everyone's just scattered everywhere and they're all individuals. And you're having basically start from scratch a new garden without any shared nutrients, any soil from which to grow.
So that would lead to like a very controversial position, because it's one thing to make this claim about like, oh, it's good that like Italian Americans move here and make their little Italian American clubs and go eat spaghetti together or whatever. But the flip side of this is that you end up having to say things like, well, historically America is an Anglo-Protestant, you know, community. And it has a certain Anglo-Protestant character and norms, and those have to be preserved, just like the Italian-Americans who move here shouldn't just dissolve into Anglo-Protestant traditions. They should keep eating spaghetti.
Or you watch West Side Story, and you're like, serves you right, kids. You know, the Sharks should have stayed with the Sharks, and the Jets should have stayed with the Jets.
That's right.
Gangs of New York, same thing. Yeah. Well, I mean, so a couple thoughts on that. One, applying what she says to Europe, which is her focus, she does say that Europe needs to maintain its Christian identity because that is the soil of its past. And she says that one of the causes of uprootedness in Europe is that it is losing its Christian past. So how do you apply that to America? It's a little bit more complicated because, like Reese says, we can barely even talk about centuries. And from the beginning, it's been a kind of a conglomeration. But I do think there is an argument.
I don't trust anything an Englishman ever says about America. That's my basic. I'm not kidding.
Well, why should I? I've lost a hearing. There's no reasoning with people like this. Throwing your tea out the pram.
Don't worry, Reese. He's a hobo. You don't have to listen to him anyway.
Yeah, it's crazy. This crazy hobo over here from San Francisco. Yeah.
But yeah, whatever source of American identity we can find in our past does need to be preserved. And I think there is something deeply wrong when you have all of these debates and wars about what even our past is or was, and what is America, what is an American. It's a very complicated issue with not necessarily clear answers, but you can see that because there aren't clear answers, it leads to a total mess.
And it was interesting, you know, our brain obviously immediately goes to these kind of questions in America and the contemporary resonance of this. But they are saying this in the middle of World War II as a French woman, which, you know, before the age of digital technology, before, you know, mass migration, before colonial decline, these are realities that she already sees at work then. So I think it's really interesting to say what did that mean for Vey in 1943, rather than leaping to kind of obvious and very pressing instances of it now. Why does she see root? You know, we would look back to 1943 and think, oh, that seems a pretty rooted time. You know, oh, you know, if only life was like that again, or 50s America. Oh, if only we had, you know, kind of life was a Norman Rockwell painting again.
So, right. What's fascinating is she goes through, most of her book is actually tracing the history of France from 1789 to World War II. To try to answer the question, essentially, how is it that the French basically, how is it that they lost all of France in 3 weeks with the German Blitz? And she says, we lost our national spirit because we didn't actually even have it before World War II. It's not really that the Nazis conquered us. We were already conquered before the Nazis ever
came. They were already conquered. That's exactly right. They couldn't fight
by themselves.
And she says the reason why they couldn't fight is multifaceted. One, because France was already dominated by what she called money power, which is that society had made economics the center of its social and political concerns. And it had – its education was in ruins. It had lost really a love of France, a love of the history of France. People weren't rooted to the land anymore. There was very little to fight for, is another way to put it. So yeah, there wasn't much fighting spirit because no one really thought there was much to fight for.
Yeah. And you know, when I read Vey and I have this conversation, you know, while I made the sort of, wow, this seems like it makes you sort of nervous to sort of have these conversations about multiculturalism or whatever. I do think ultimately you can say there's way too much to be said for that position to discount it on any grounds. And so, like, what's the alternative? You know, melting pot sounds good, but I think it sounds good because we tend to mean, when we talk about a melting pot, we don't actually think about a melting pot. We actually think about sort of colonizing other culture, like grafting other cultures into the American culture, right? Mm-hmm. So we tend to think that there is this American culture, and we're going to bring these people here, and we're going to make them into Americans. And I think
they're the ones who are going to melt. They'll melt.
That's exactly right. Their culture is going to melt, and we're going to bring them into our community. And I think that's one way through. And I think that is possible. So I remember visiting Aberdeen for my PhD and meeting this guy who ran like the bed and breakfast, who had married a Scotswoman, and he was like Taiwanese, but he had like pictures of himself in kilts with his like, you know, half Chinese, half Scottish children. Like he's like a Scotsman. He like spoke with a sort of Chinese Scottish accent. And you're like, all right, you know, this is the alternative, and that works, and can work, I think, because, and that's always been the case, right? So this is, it goes back to Ruth, right? Your people will be my people, your gods will be my gods. You can sort of graft yourself in. It's unclear that you can graft a community in, and it's unclear that the alternative to these two options, right? One is you keep your community, and your community lives as a subculture inside of another community. The other way is you graft yourself into that community, which is probably a better term than melting pot. Mm-hmm. The only third alternative, which is where I think, you know, certain trends are moving, is what I will call the uncanny valley of culturalism. And, you know, like you see these posters. I saw a poster on a side of a bus, and it was like a face, but like every slice it was sliced into like 16 portions, and each slice was a different gender and culture and race. And you look at it and it looks kind of vaguely human, but like very anti-human in a certain sense. And, you know, I was with some students and I pointed it out. And I was like, you know, how does that strike you? And everybody was like, yeah, it's kind of horrifying. And actually a student said, it looks like the Uncanny Valley. It looks like AI art. And, you know, when you ask AI to sort of make these people, like they don't really look like people, you know, because how do people look? You know, the neighborhood I live in Oakland, mostly Latino and Asian and some blacks and some whites. And yet when you go to the school, most of the kids in the neighborhood are actually Latinos. And when my kid was in the local school, they did Bailo Folklorico and everybody had to put on the, you know, the little Mexican outfits and do the dance. And it didn't, I mean, many of those Latino kids aren't Mexican. But the largest percent were, and so that's what they did. And it's like, it's healthy to have some culture that is like a norm to norm to. Mm-hmm. And we are ourselves like the little, you know, colonial outpost of like Anglo-Protestant culture, you know, my Chinese American wife and I, you know, in this neighborhood. And so I don't know, is that sort of using her taxonomy and then trying to apply it to the sort of contemporary craziness of the American scene?
Yes.
Makes sense?
It does. Okay. I think that's really well put. It is that third way, the uncanny valley way, as you put it, I think is the most rootless approach and ultimately the most destructive. And you actually lose, using the soil analogy, you lose any concrete soil from which to grow and create. It's this idea that you can just continually create and recreate new cultures, new societies, new collectives without drawing from anything consistent, anything from the past, anything.
And that, yeah. And that image that you're looking at when you look at the uncanny, you know, cultural image, it's not ever something that can grow, right? You give me an image of any human, and that's a thing that can grow. But the other image that's clearly constructed can only be made. And I think that's the real concern that I have with it.
Kind of like a sterile clone.
That's right. It has to be manufactured. Yep. And if we wanted people to look like this, we're going to have to make them, because they will not become this way, you know, left to their own devices.
It's like maybe applying Oliver O'Donovan's begotten, not made idea to collectives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to sort of the political sphere as opposed to the individual.
Mm. Well, I think we may wrap up there with that nice link to our other episodes of talking about Oliver O'Donovan. Again, High on Our Own Supply is a regular feature on the Advantes podcast. Thank you, Nathan, for taking us through your thoughts on Vey and that piece. We'll link it in the show notes, and it's on the Advantes website, When Rights Go Wrong. So go and read the original there and see what on earth we've been talking about. we'll move from that into talking about what else we're reading. We've been reading Nathan's piece. Nathan's been reading Simone Weil, but we'd like to talk about what else we're reading. Nathan's our guest. What have you been reading apart from Simone Weil and The Need for Roots?
Well, my day job is being a college professor, so I'm reading all the stuff that I'm teaching my students. So we're going through, we just finished Plato's Republic, and we're moving on to reading Seneca, his On the Happy Life. I'm just immersed in Plato, Aristotle, Stoics, Epicureans, the ancient world. I've also been reading, I don't know if you've heard of this guy, but Thomas Traherne. I've been reading his, well, there's this modernization called The Shining Human Creature of his ethics. Been reading that, and that's been delightful. I hear that the second volume is coming out sometime soon, too.
Is that true, Reese?
That's the talk on the, that's the word on the street, you know, out there in the melting pot. That's what that's what the Sharks and the Jets are talking about. That's true, yeah.
Out in the Uncanny Valley.
Uncanny Valley, yeah. You've leapt what I was going to spotlight for us later on, but this is a project of Collins. So we'll talk about that when we spotlight it shortly afterwards. But you've actually been reading it, Nathan, or you've just just bumping up Collins.
It's been
here.
Sunday reading for me. It's been really delightful. I get to go through it slowly, and the language I find to be just particularly rich, as well as, of course, the. Mm. The ideas and its continuity with classical thought is very nice.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah. Colin, what have you been...
I take it as a high compliment. I have not been getting high on my own supply.
For once.
I've been reading Frederick Douglass's autobiography. I just got a chance to teach the other day. I'm kind of in Nathan's situation where I do a lot of teaching, and so most of my reading is either related to the teaching or research these days. And there's a scene, so Frederick Douglass, famous American slave who sort of gets to freedom and then becomes an abolitionist, and he gets, you know, invited to have lunch with Lincoln and things like this, and was famous actually mostly for his public speeches. So he was an orator, one of the original American bodybuilders. We still have his weights from when he would lift weights, and he did it because... he wanted to be imposing on stage, and he didn't want anyone to be able to look at him and say, that's a boy. He wanted them to look at him and say, that's a man, because that would be the traditional term that you would have used in, in the antebellum period to talk about black men in particular, because you didn't want to sort of acknowledge them as citizens and equals. So anyhow, my favorite scene, which is worth admitting, is he says, I've told you how a man can be made a slave. Let me tell you how a slave is made of man. Oh. And then he talks about how one day he's at the, like, this guy who was a slave breaker, famously Mr. Covey, and he's just beating the snot out of Douglas. And Douglas, while he's on the ground and the guy's leaning over and beating him, reaches up his hand and grabs him by the throat and then stands up while holding him. And Covey grabs him by the throat, and they're standing there looking at each other, squeezing one another, and he says blood is coming out of where his fingers are on Covey's throat, and Covey has to call his buddies over. And until his buddies get there, he's able to sort of hold his own, stand his ground. And he says, from that moment on, I was beaten many times, but I was never whipped again. And eventually, 4 years later, he does get his freedom. But there's major questions from contemporary scholars about whether or not he actually is sort of a Christian, or whether his Christianity is itself merely esoteric and he's actually just kind of a vitalist. And that scene, I think, is really the one that makes you think maybe this really is just, because the way that a slave becomes a man apparently is not because of a realization about yourself and God. I mean, he'd already learned how to read. He taught himself how to read. It's the way that a slave becomes a man is by rising up and looking your master in the eye and saying, I'm not going to take it anymore.
I'd rather die to death. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to strangle you to death. So, yeah. Nice. And then he says lots of nice things about God later on, and some harsh words about the churches in America. But it doesn't show up right there, and so it just makes you wonder. But anyway, it's beautifully written. So that's what I've been reading. How about yourself, Reese?
Yeah, I want to go and read Frederick Douglass now. I studied it as an undergrad, but haven't been back to it. Actually, very timely and apposite for Nathan's piece. I've got it on my desk, actually. I've been reading a book called Covenant The New Politics of Home, Neighbourhood and Nation by Danny Kruger, who is a Conservative MP here in the UK. He's a evangelical Christian. He spoke earlier this year at NatCon UK and has just launched a new kind of think tanky, initiative-y kind of thing called the New Conservatives. And this is kind of very in step with what Vey's pushing against. He sets up this idea of we're born into a social covenant rather than all entering into a social contract. And all the big kind of, you know, conservative, cool, let's diagnose what's wrong with modernity names that, you know, us and probably some of our readers are familiar with are in here. Charles Taylor, Paul Kingsnorth, all the interesting guys are in there. So it's quite remarkable, actually, for me to have read the kind of stuff that maybe people who read Davenant and adjacent publications and outlets to read that kind of stuff written in a small manifesto by an actual sitting member of the Conservative Party. It actually has given me some hope. You know, on the day of recording, Labour have just won a landslide by-election in a seat in Scotland, which seems to be indicating a very likely prospect of them winning a majority at whatever our next general election is. So who knows if we'll have enough Conservative MPs or if Kruger will keep his seat. But he's in a very safe rural Conservative constituency. So if he keeps his seat in the next election, something like this gives me a modicum of hope that there will at least be a sensible dissent within the Conservatives that actually wants to conserve things and deal with our contemporary ills at some level. Yeah, but would highly recommend, especially to any British listeners. Yeah.
So moving... both of our British listeners,
both of them,
Reese's mom and his brother, you know, go buy the book.
If there are two people who have never, ever listened to a single podcast I've recorded, it's my mum and my brother, my dad. The only people who, only person who's probably consumed less of what I've produced over the years would be my wife.
There are people at the Davenant Institute who wonder if my wife exists. So, but Anzi met her this summer, so he can vouch for me.
The hired hand. Moving from what we've been reading into spotlighting, which Nathan has already taken us to, we do have the second volume of Thomas Traherne's Christian Ethics on its way, due for publication on the 14th of November. We published the first instalment, The Shining Human Creature, back earlier this year, and Colin's been beavering away on his modernization of the second instalment, Made Like the Maker is the subtitle of that. Colin, give us a little summary of Traherne's overall project and this volume in particular.
Yeah, well, first, my goal is to beat Brad Littlejohn. So he's been trying to modernize for over a decade Hooker's Ecclesiastical Laws of England, and I started after him, but this is a classic tortoise and the hare. He was really fast out the gate, and he's been sort of sitting on his haunches, and here I've just been, as you said, beavering away, and maybe I'll say turtling away. So we'll see, you know, Brad, if you're listening, the race is on. Let's see who wins this sucker. In this volume, you know, Traherne really gets into particular virtues. And so he talks about, you know, he talks about wisdom and other natural virtues. And then he begins the process of talking about theological virtues, virtues like hope. And, you know, one of the features of it that struck me as I was reading it, and it's actually something that carries over. So all the themes, right? This is one book that we're breaking into four parts because nobody's going to sit down and read, you know, over 400 pages of a modernization of a text of virtue ethics from, you know, hundreds of years ago. But if you break it into smaller bits, you modernize it for people, you make it digestible, you give little footnotes so that they can follow along with some of the trickier philosophical bits. You know, hopefully it becomes something that's valuable and even devotional, right? Like Nathan's using it. But one of the features of this one is he talks again and again about how virtues sort of make us and how God made us to be virtuous and somehow we're related to God in our making and God has made us to make. And that theme is scattered throughout his work. And of course, Thomas Traherne himself is not only a philosopher who's thinking about virtue and a theologian who's thinking about God, but he's also a poet. and his own poetry, his own making of poetry is scattered throughout his text. So I have a bit of a different kind of an introduction that I hope people will engage and think about and maybe even respond to somewhere. In the first volume, the one that you have, Nathan, the introduction is like, here's who Thomas Traherne is, you know, and I put a lot of love into that. But it would be boring to just do that again and again. So in this one, I'm trying to do a little bit of interpretive work to think about the theories that are sort of behind the text and open those up for people. And the ultimate theory is that God made us, and so we reflect God's image. And that has a particular structure that we don't often hear people articulating. The relationship between our thinking, our language, and our activity with our hands. And you can then see that not only in scripture, not only in our lives, you can also sort of see it functioning in Traherne's text as well. So that's the introductory essay.
Yeah, I've been working as the editor on this little volume, and the volume itself is great. And then Colin's introductory essay is worth the price of the book. So go and pre-order. I'll put the link in the show notes. You can go on the Davenant website and go to the bookstore section and find it there. Okay, well, as we approach the end of the episode, if you've enjoyed what you've heard, then please do like, subscribe, share, leave us a positive review. Also, if you want to support what we do here at Advantes, we are a donor and reader-supported publication. So you can go on the Advantes website if you've not already and subscribe. You can get a digital subscription or a print-only subscription or a digital and print subscription starting from as little as $2.50. of your Yankee dollars a month. If you want to support what we do and keep us in a job, then do go and subscribe. But if you haven't liked what you've heard, Colin, what should they do?
If you haven't liked what you've heard, you need to leave your house and you need to walk to your nearest train station, and just as one's swinging past, just reach out a hand like in a cartoon and just leap onto it. And let it take you, you know, wherever it takes you. And when you get wherever you're going, you just walk into the nearest coffee shop. You say, does anybody have an iPhone? And they say yes. And you go and you search Advantes Podcast in their podcast app. And you click subscribe so that we get a new subscriber out of this deal. You get a new life as a hobo. And we can have a 1-star review and you can tell us why you didn't like it on their iPhone.
Welcome to all our new hobo listeners, wherever you may be. Right, well, Nathan, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to have you and to talk about your essay.
Yeah, thanks for having me. The highlight of my life. I have arrived now. I really have nowhere else to go.
If it makes you that happy, we really do have to have you back. I had no idea.
Great. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us. I don't know what we'll be doing next time, actually. Maybe we'll be back in Begotten or Made. Maybe we'll be speaking to another writer. Who knows? This is the Editors and Writers Podcast, after all. This has been the Advantes Podcast. We are the Editors and Writers, and we will see you next time.